Ida from the Green Bay area, Green Bay, Wisconsin. So we're changing geography a little bit here. Her academic training and background include an undergraduate degree from the University of Wisconsin and a Master's of Fine Arts from the University of Montana at Missoula, where she studied under Richard Hugo and was also a fellow student of James Welch, who we'll have here after spring break. Roberta is currently faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and is also a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, working on her doctorate degree. Roberta has published in various magazines and anthologies, including Carriers of the Dream Wheel, American Poetry Review, The Nation, and North American Review. She is also the author of Star Quilt, a collection of her poems, and she's currently in the process of doing a biography of her grandmother, who was one of the first Native American physicians. This morning, I had the pleasure of being with Roberta and some of our students as she spoke to us of her background. And I not only listened to her, but I watched her speak. And she reminded me so much of another Seneca woman, another Iroquois woman who I knew for some time. And similarly, as this, my Seneca friend used to speak about the land in the East and their situation there and how different and often how similar situations are with the indigenous people here in the Southwest. But in watching her, I also remembered, you know, what a strong and handsome people the Iroquois are. I would like to think that perhaps sometime, if something should happen to our world, and if there was a remote possibility that we were to come out of it, I think that I would like to follow these Iroquois women out of here. Iroquois women, of course, being the Seneca and the Cayuga and the Onondaga and certainly the Oneida. So would you please welcome Roberta Hill Whiteman?
Thank you for the introduction. I'm very honored to be here and to share with you my work. This has been quite an experience to see the interest that people have here in the literature. And I'll just begin by reading a few poems from Star Quilt, and then I'll read some other work that is much more recent. My husband and I met in the late 70s, and when we met, we had both lived on opposite ends of the country. He's in Wyoming, he was in Wyoming, and I was in Wisconsin. And so when we first then started getting together and meeting one another, I wrote a poem that's included in Star Quilt, and it's a love poem. It's called A Song for What Never Arrives. We aren't like those who kiss like fishes, lightly, easily, quickly gone. Let's sink entwined to those reaches beyond this human world, where tongues of ripples form familiar kinship. Inside me, summer leaves have begun a meditation, and I wake from dreams as one might wake from fever, bewildered by the smoke billowing from my neighbor's chimney. When the vacant sapphire sky finds an alley of black trees, I feel you haunt an unknown layer of my heart. How can I set in order this debris? It's all I am. Charmed by illusion, by nature consistently cruel and kind, born to confusion, perhaps we shouldn't plan to arrive at the end of love, but should move inside its mystery like chickadees, those acrobats darting in and out of branches paled by frost. Perhaps it's best we accept the thrum of water alone. Like weeds, we grow submerged in shadows, feeding on the last fire of a stone. Yet we can emerge from our lagoon, so tangled up that children reaching for one tinted bloom will gather both, blazing quietly as stars. My husband and I married in 1980, and we have children who are 17, 16, and 15, so we work real quickly. They grew real quickly. Actually, it was our second marriage for both of us, and the children are from our earlier marriages. And so we had to become a blended family. And one of the experiences that we had, the children met each other when they were 3, 4, and 5. And one of the experiences that I treasure in those early years is that we went to a park on Mother's Day called Newport Beach, which, if you're familiar with Wisconsin, you know, it's shaped like a hand, and then the thumb, the park is at the very end of the thumb in Wisconsin, the end of that peninsula. And it was an amazing kind of place. I had never seen such a park with so many different kinds of ecologies. And we went on a trail called Lynn Point Trail. And it was the experience of watching these young children feel so very at home there, wanting to stay there. They wanted to dance through the park, and they wanted to gather things and stay there. And yet we knew that, of course, we wouldn't be able to do that. The poem is called Lynn Point Trail. That rare day, we played for real and left traces of our walking sticks in last year's leaves. Lynn Point Trail hid us in rushing green, in the thick dark of Douglas fir, where death conceals itself in blazing moss. Leading us in the journey, our children stomp danced until the ferns bristled with the authority of hooded cobras. When they turned to us for answers, we began to see fronds tremble with a delicate weight, as if infinity stirred the stem. The scattered light peopled each ravine. We longed for woods this deep, for this glen where you knelt to photograph a gleam inside a bridge of stone. Was it then Missy wouldn't go on? Our youngest girl wanted to believe home could be this emerald grotto. Nearby, we heard the breaking sigh of waves, while bickering in a bird's staccato, she kept her gesture firm, though naive. Here we belonged. A cuckoo's call echoed in the sun. I too wish we could have lived near the tilted horizon, close to the fluttering mat that weaves dunfly and dune into one. With songs for granite and bluer skies, children gathered rain-eroded shells. Let these rocks be eggs until the tides scorch them, or until the heart reveals at last the grace we lost. There was one poem that I sent when people asked me to send some poems, and it comes from the experience of traveling out to Wind River, Wyoming, a totally different kind of land than what I'm familiar with. I'm familiar with woods and lakes and a closed horizon and heavy clouds. And out on the Wind River Reservation, it's very much like this, where you can see mountains in the distance and you can see all kinds of levels of land. And while we were out there at a place called Dimwoody, it's called, near a place that's called the Lake That Roars, there were some women that came to visit or stop and chat with my husband and I. And they were magnificent looking women, I thought. They were in their 50s and they were on horses, on horseback. And they were had this sort of presence about them that made me feel very happy to meet them and to watch them. And after they had left, my husband started telling me how they were related to one of his relatives and the kind of life that they had lived, and that people didn't always treasure sisters who lived very close to their mother and who managed to help her raise her cattle, you know, who would have been thought in some contexts, I guess, as old maids. But, you know, they were really inspiring, I thought. And so I wrote a poem for them and for their relative, and it's called Home Before Dark. And it incorporates a bit of the legend of the place. There are stories in that area about a white buffalo who was being chased by Shoshones and went up into this lake area. And he took his herd out onto the ice. And when he was driven out onto the ice, the weight of the herd on the ice caused them all to fall under the water. And they disappeared. But the Shoshones say that that buffalo bull is still there, because you can still hear it bellowing at times in those canyons. The poem, Home Before Dark. From mountain ridges west, a reluctant sun alarms clouds to the east, giving them the salmon tint of dawn long before it's due. Other clouds crop indigo in distant canyons. Crowheart Butte floats in this last light as two Shoshone women gallop home before dark. Rain sharpens the wind, blending the smell of damp earth and sagebrush with the sound of their sorrel horses. Sunlight on the brims of their cowboy hats, these sisters, close to 50, ride joyously over this land of a thousand levels. Beaded roses flashing from their buckles, they leap wagon ruts, trot over the plateau. Some folks call them backward, say they wear shawls in town, herd livestock for their mother, tan hides, and never married. Clouds group behind them over Black Mountain. The women head for a southerly range, away from the lake that roars, where Shoshone warriors once hunted a buffalo bull and his herd. White as a glacier and twice as mean, he thundered onto ice, his herd right behind. Snow crust enveloping their heavy sighs, they went down. Since then, the bull bellows for revenge. Some say it's only wind through canyons, but others tell of men who've tasted forbidden meat and changed to shaggy heads. Clouds stamp out ledges and ravines, careen closer, hiding the more difficult terrain. Now one shadow moving toward the timberline, these women hurry on. Behind them, on Black Mountain, snow in every crevice, brilliant as a cry. I was very interested in the The title of this series, Poetics and Politics. And I thought perhaps I should put all my poems that are political toward one section and then put the other poems in another section. And then I realized that all poems are political. And so some you may hear are more political than others. But I'm building up to that. So making friends. This next poem is about my son. He's about 17 now, but when he was a bit younger, he wanted to go across country with a group of people from Ireland, some young men who came over from Ireland to get some relief from the kinds of encounters that they were having there. And he went across to California, over to the, I think it's one of those large parks just north of Los Angeles. And it was my first experience in having him say, I'm taking off and I'm going to be gone for a long time and I'll see you around, Ma, you know? And so I had to get used to the fact that he was growing up and I had to let him go. And we have a saying, you know, at home that my father often reminded me, and I remind my children, is that our real parents are the earth and sky, you know, and that I am just, you know, helping the earth along, and the father, their father, is just helping the sky along. And so in this poem, I allow myself to comfort and to find some comfort in that process. It's called Letting Go. Under blue dome where mountain spirits wander, he curls in a green bedroll, listening, 13 years old. When the tent flap flutters, he remembers TJ stuffing Gorp into his backpack, the grizzly snorting all night long through their camp in Sequoia, until the dawn ranger reported bear disturbance, no one injured. In a wind-swollen flash of sparks and ash, I hope he hears a mountain spirit dancing nearby, her stony breath pressing him as much as the womanly night. I had to let him go, my gangly eagle child, struggling to ride currents of life's uplifting wind. Yet then, as now and always, when pines mimic ocean swells, I want his radiant childhood to carry him back to me, like phosphorus returning to a warm southern sea. Even though night's rapture grows between us, each time he telephones, distant as my own myth of mountains, I listen for the shift in tone that tells me he's encountered his true mother. At daybreak, her iridescent song drifts from a canyon hidden in our dreams, and we seem to rise from our own power. So skilled is her vision. I had to let him go, encounter his true father in rings of even starshine and boulders. Perched on a limb of a salt-rimmed tree, watching the heavy sea brighten as twilight grows, I hope he'll learn manhood needs both action and repose. How I long to save him from the miseries of war. Enough have died so far in this quest for empire. His true parents strengthen his willingness to love, his high-strung mirth in the boardwalk's glare, his dragging TJ from the undertow. Cicadas flutter their flimsy but persistent wings until the buzzsaw of their passion stings July heat. As storm clouds rise and rains pommel oaks. I notice in a lightning flash the roads gone thin. Suffering this sea change, I peek again from the kitchen window. Every light is on and every curtain open. One of those things that many Native people have in common is the kind of foods that we grow and care about. And as much as I can, wherever I am, I try to like to grow corn and, if possible, beans and squash, and maybe a few other things also. And sometimes I'm real successful and sometimes I'm not real successful. But the thing that's amazing about corn, if you think of it, is that it creates so much of itself that it's one of those food crops that enables us to have a democracy, you know, because it creates so many seeds from itself that it offers us an abundance of food. And so I like to think of that, and I like to think of the fact that it's male and female. So that, you know, when you go out into a cornfield in midsummer, think of all the energies that are moving through the cornfield between the male and female corn. You know, you can kind of feel it sometimes. So I wrote a poem, it's like a song, called Praising Corn. Green spiral meeting summer sun, green vertigo unwinding from the ground, green shoot like a tongue tasting earth and rain, mirror of our movement swirling like water down a drain, long leaves flashing big as banners, a string of dewdrops rippling to the centers. Young men with diamond cuffs and open arms, whose headdresses toss in wind and sun, like ones accustomed to dance and drum. You've garnered the sun's flowers in your leaves. We hoe and hoe, tear away weeds. You soak up rain, toss your pollen 7 rows. Young women catch it, grow all in a season, ready to give at the height of summer, ready to be cut down when night hurls meteors and nighthawks journey south. Thundering and tumbling under gunpowder clouds, beautiful spirits corn, because of you we live. This next poem came from reading a work by a woman named Rigoberto Manchu. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. And I was very struck by the kinds of experiences that she had and the willingness that she had to speak about them and to share them with people. And one of the things that really struck me was when she said she wanted to be acknowledged as a human being. I thought that it was a very long kind of a process, you know, beginning, if you think, with Columbus, for Native peoples to be recognized as human beings. And I felt a really strong connection to the people in Guatemala and wrote a poem that uses some of the mythology from down there to talk about the connections that we have to the struggle going on for the people, the Indian people, all up and down this continent, but particularly in Guatemala. And she said, "I fight so that they will recognize me and treat me like a human being." And the poem is called Acknowledgement. Listen, for the Lord of the near and close comes to make you see. In steam rising from coffee, smoke from bodies burning in panzos. Sometime he'll have you taste in your chocolate bars, that bitterness children carry when they dare not bury their bludgeoned mothers. On the backs of owls, Zichik woman's blood flew out of smoldering hells, carrying within her twins who restored freedom to those sunlit mountains. Sometimes she'll have you smell in the red and fragrant flowers the hearts of boy soldiers hanging in trees. Where is the mirror that makes all things shine? The night winds, my lord. He cleans the bodies flung in ravines and comforts aching women standing before their fragile fires. His breath's a spiral wide as this galaxy where nothing is obscured. Obsidian butterfly will force you to see how children sleep in a cardboard box year after tremulous year. In the span of their hands, onions, gruel, and a dangerous abyss for the people of this sun. In clouds and mist, their suffering moves. Something comes to wake you. Something comes without faltering. Can you feel it in the twilight, in your fruits and in your cheeses, in your signatures? The gods and goddesses are talking together, scanning dumpsters and smog, nuclear playgrounds. They soothe cholera-stricken geese and the broken feet of coyotes. In their diminishing forests, they meet, counting the heartbeats it will take to make each face sublime. Will you acknowledge the love and faith of our restless earth? Or will you claim the sufferings too far south, while your mouth samples and measures, calls everything tangible? Through darkness, through night, our suffering moves, a slow quake in the chest, a sigh. No food and the body will eat itself. Some of you bluster and do not believe we have cut the heart of the sky. You give gasoline to the lords of your death, spoon out the sugar, ignoring its tears. I guess in looking at that poem, you know, the you in the poem was, of course, for the people who have that kind of control and who don't recognize those kinds of connections that we all have, you know, to one another, the relationships that we have to one another. I think I'll read another sort of a shorter poem. I lived a lot of my life, you know, and a lot of anger and a lot of despair. And I realized at a certain point that I had to let a lot of that go and trust in things. And there was one moment when that started to happen. And it was down here in this area in the Southwest. I was at Santa Fe. And I had this incredible experience of just sleeping under a full moon. And all of a sudden, I felt that the moon was watching me, you know, that the moon and I were somehow talking, and I really couldn't quite understand it. And maybe it was, you know, a moment of insanity, which I treasure, you know. I think we need moments of insanity like that, that we'd really treasure. Maybe that's the kind of reality that we need to come back to. But that kind of moment gave me a lot of connection to feeling free of despair for a very long time. I don't think I've felt the kind of despair I once felt since that. And when I got back home, I thought of it, and I thought I should remember this experience. And so I wrote a poem. And this is for all of you who might feel that kind of sense of despair and hope that you can let it go and find some connections out there in the world, in the earth, the sky. It's called No Longer. I no longer fear the firestorm, despair. Green earth has coaxed my soul over a blue bridge of forget-me-nots into her hollow of oak leaves, lilies. Now each creek I cross balances dark and day, as birds give no thought to each wing's weight, but fly singing. I no longer expect the firestorm despair to sear the ground I grow on. Horns of sumac have broken my blindness. Thunder's taste glitters on my lips. The moon urges my blood roots burgeoning. Her fierce song cools this light I feed on. Together we travel this river of fervid stars. I think what I'll do is to read another poem about my experiences traveling. I had the opportunity to go to China a few years ago, in 89, the year before Tiananmen Square happened. And I felt there was a real strong connection, you know, to the kinds of writers that I'd met in China, and to the experience of being an Indian person in China. I felt connection to the number of the writers there. Some of them were Chinese and some of them were Tibetan. And we went over to Chengdu and traveled all through China. We stayed, the conference was in Chengdu, which is in a marvelous area where there are very tall mountains, very pointed kinds of mountains, very green mountains, and it was a beautiful experience. And I still have a feeling of connectedness sometimes when I think of those people, you know, and wonder how they are. I think we get images in the air and from the earth, you know, that come to us. And I think that's our way of really communicating with one another. But we're taught not to pay attention to those things, you know. We're spacing out or daydreaming or whatever. But I like to pay attention to that. So this is a poem for those writers that I had met over there. And it's called Traveling. If you're not familiar with some of the Chinese writers, there's one that I mentioned, a poet named Du Fu, who lived in what is called the City of Brocade. And he was a very well-known poet. His whole family comes from a series of very well-known, famous poets. But he met ill favor with the court and, of course, was sent out exile and traveled for a very long time throughout China and wrote a lot of his poems while he was traveling. The poem is called Traveling. The moon on the rim of my world skims westward over ripples of cirrus haze. It is the orange sail of a junk I follow, traveling in indigo twilight. Do you know, in order to sleep, I read Tibetan poetry, Chinese history. The Zun wavers in unfamiliar air, quicksilver above the gearing down of trucks leaving the nearby freeway. Sometimes, when I lift the lid of my cup, tea leaves catch my heart in hidden currents, and I remember orchid petals trembling in the tea house of Du Fu in his City of Brocade. He knew what strengths arrive with exile. Sometimes those lagoons inundate my daily life and I wait while ripples of jade surge against my shoulders. I wait while the mountains of Lashan unravel roads around the horizon of my afternoon. We travel with common heartbeats now, though half a world away, you too write toward dawn alone. Does someone watch you from beyond for that single indiscretion? Tiptoeing across tight ropes of ideology, carrying only the asylum of my words, I want to reach you, but I cannot make them minarets or gorges, breath crystals drifting in an azure sky, the way your native tongue looks to me on paper. You said a gold thread binds all things together. Can I find it here? Sometimes I long for sweet sour carp and garlic shoots. Do you ever scour the underground for books on Indian nations beyond your eastern sea? True to the drum and bell sound of my soul, I dance these pictures into wind and send them on the backs of ocean waves, because I wanted you to know every now and then I cannot sleep until I touch my fingers to the earth to feel if you're still rising on the other side. For those of you who might not know that, it's very risky to be an artist in China, you know, because the country swings so radically between being open to Western influence and being shut. And one of the writers before we left recognized that they were at the point when it would shut down and try to get rid of, you know, Western influences. And he was a very brave man who had spent probably about 29 years in prison for his writing. And again, then at this time, he had come out to write and to be recognized as a writer. And the writers who write and are interested in Western literature and English and the kinds of things that we were discussing could have also been considered decadent again and sent back to prison. So I admired their willingness to continue with their art in spite of such tremendous, potentially frightening kinds of obstacles. Well, I don't know if you're familiar, perhaps, with large bodies of water. Are there lakes here? Do you have lakes? No? Well, of course, I live near the Great Lakes, or that's where my people are from, is near the Great Lakes, and we have very large bodies of water. And I thought that I ought to send you some images of the great bodies of water and the trees and the birds. And the storms, I understand you do have tremendously heavy storms in the summer. So this is about two very large fronts meeting one another over the water. And it was kind of an incredible experience to watch them and to feel, you know, that they were rumbling and talking to one another, and you could see them kind of going along, and then here we were on kind of the earth, and then of course you knew that there were other things going on underneath the water, underneath the land. So this is about a place called Shiguamigan Bay. If you're ever up near northern Wisconsin, you might want to go up there because it's a very beautiful place. And the poem is called Of Light, Water, and Gathered Dust. Above Shiguamigan Bay, two immense assemblies of summer clouds collide, flare with messages, and rumble their rejection. With massive strides, they edge each other, bunch-backed by a low cauliflower, the eastern front drives daggers of rain into the dove-gray water between them. The western flyers snap green whips, forcing cruise ships home. When the lightning flashes, you name a shore hovering in midair. Other islands out there are shrewd as submerging monsters, eyes flickering in the dusk. The gull's transparent cries are blown along a low cliff. Wings awry from wind, they read it, then balance again, swinging like pendants beyond us. Crickets resist the wind and sing. Orange and red lightning explodes in dizzy loops. Two flashes zig from top-down cloud. The bay surges over rocks, its fish aware of an upper world. Look, I say, in that flash, the oak grove we walked through last spring. Crickets approve, sing louder than before. As shreds of cauliflower fall earthward, house lights on Madeline Island dim. Above the scattering clouds, Jupiter close as the motel door, and the Milky Way no longer remote, but bright as your laughter in the dark. The footprints of souls who walked this earth plain whirl around us, through us, beyond us, into us. Born of light, water, and gathered dust, we grope for one another's hand and trust the galaxy's embrace as leaves trust air, as thunder its cloud. You throw your cigarette over the rail. It grows a tail and travels through a slow glowing arc. For that moment, even crickets pause. Well, I'm going to read another political poem. I don't know if you're familiar with the things that are going on in northern Wisconsin. The issue of Indian treaty rights and the question of the development of mines. There is a large copper deposit in northern Wisconsin, and for a while what stopped Anaconda mining out of Australia, a multinational mining corporation, was nine people on the Mole Lake Reservation up in northern Wisconsin who claimed that any kind of mining development needed to recognize that the Indian people in northern Wisconsin had reserve rights. And there have been tremendous encounters over the last several years between the Indian spear fishermen who have gone out and exercised those rights to spear on the lakes, and organizations that claim that they need to have equal rights for all Americans, but their major interest is, of course, to support the mining interests and to prevent Indians from spearfishing and from exercising their rights. So the spearfishing controversy is not necessarily one about fish. It's really about the rights of Indian people, the questions that they have over the environmental safety, how it will affect them in the water, and the development, the process of development that could go on and really rip up the northern woods in Wisconsin all across the northern area. And when I had thought of these things and was taking a course, I took a course with a professor from Chile whose name is Hernan Vidal, and he showed me a number of things to think about in terms of the connections between northern Wisconsin and the kinds of mining that had gone on in Chile. And so this poem was written for him, and it kind of moves around, I guess. But one of the things that started me thinking about it is that in one of the places in northern Wisconsin, in a pizza parlor, there was a sign posted for the first annual Indian shoot to think of how a person could kill off an Indian lawyer and get 100 points, shoot an Indian teacher and get another couple hundred points. And so there was a whole listing of this kind of racism, you know, that was posted throughout the area, and that's one example of how sad that area had become. Fortunately, there's a restraining order that just came down last fall so that the people who are in those organizations are no longer allowed to interfere with Indian spear fishermen and women out on the lakes. So it will start when I get back in March. They'll go out on the lake, start going out on the lakes, and hopefully the restraining order will hold. This poem is called Preguntas, which means questions. You said one time offhandedly, your bones contain your people's history. Professor, no one wrote it down. Did you know in my home state, the bones in my fingers and scruffed them across the sign? It is not the first, the right finger bone sang. It has never been annual, the left ones added. Do I look like a deer to you, Professor? Or a quail preening in the back corner of the room against the wall and window? I warble to the air of the classroom. Okay, okay, so I'll be a bird. La Guarda Barranca, who lives in these ravines on the underside of American history. From these thickets, in the shadow of his years, my father sits at our table near the window telling stories. The west wind knew how to listen and sometimes sends his voice back to me whenever my blood falters. I welcomed his singing in the dark, his sobbing in the dark, paralyzed at times in his struggle against the daily snare of being declared worthless. Because of him, I know my flesh is corn come from earth. Because of him, I know my body is a hologram of all that is and ever was. What fear drives them, Professor? What makes them want to annihilate these memories of our bones and blood? Bones breaking silence, speak. Words finding wings, fly. Wings bringing clouds, whirl. Clouds bearing rain, fall on those fields that uphold justice. They want hurt and rage to cement our bones so we can't dance by them. They want us drunk and armed whenever we ride across northern Wisconsin. Then they'll call us terrorists, savages, call newsmen in to see our hides tacked to garage doors because we question the word civilized openly against this treeless horizon, because we declare ourselves original human beings. Professor, sometimes across your face floats a cloud of loneliness and loss, of solidarity with those who suffer. You draw a schema on the blackboard to reveal the wheel of fragments in which we live. Although you clearly show us contradictions like gears grinding every one of us into sand, the schema have not taught me as much as the sundown cloud across your face when you speak of justice. You have helped me understand. Their fear of the dark is not my identity. Their Indian shoot doesn't create wiggle room for a few more fish. It's not about fish, but fake blue lakes. Not about trees, but copper. Sometimes the wind brings to my window my father's voice with the voices of others. Akwesasne, Tlatelolco, Lactoflambo, El Salvador. Because of you, I trust, bones breaking silence will speak, words finding wings will fly, wings bringing clouds will whirl, and whirling clouds filled with oblique rain will fall on those fields that answer these questions of justice. So, thank you. So you can feel real happy about the rain, you know? I'll read just a few more poems. Let's see. Okay. I'm going to read another poem once again. There's two more that I'd like to share with you. One of them is a fairly recent poem, and it's about just growing up in a city, you know, and trying to figure out about what it meant to, what do they call that, sort of consciousness where your mind is colonized, you know, where you feel like, you know, you're one person in one situation, and then in another way you have to be someone else. How in some ways many of us have had to live in the city and not really reveal in some ways who we were. And so the poem is called Our Different Story. After my father returned from the war, he gave each of us a mask to wear, like the one his mother gave him, made of gauze. Wear this, he said, so they won't see that you belong to a different story. When you enter their world, what they do won't hurt so much. We wore the flimsy gauze that smelled like a dusty curtain. It tickled our ears, ruffled over our arms, and draped down our backs like a bride's long veil. Its moiré patterns dazzled our sleep, but we still lifted it from our faces to dance inside our different story. When we got hurt or grew afraid, we chided each other, "You don't wear it right." We never thought its whisper could run around our heads for years. Do you hear it muttering now? My sisters, we hugged each other when it grew too tight against our eyes like a sour bandage. We squinted past its mottled light at dark green fields beyond its threshold. Boyfriends who refused to wear it had it stapled on their faces in places called prison or boarding school. Inez told father the gauze was cutting us whenever we tried to rip it from our foreheads. But father's mask by then became the cast of light in winter. He couldn't remember the day his mother gave him his. He felt our pain, but could not stop what had become its steady hum. Do you hear it now, my sisters, that television in a far-off room? I find it fluttering over me at times, Like those nights, my sister threw a sheet high as the stucco ceiling. Its cool nap skipped down my face, my thighs. If I could lie still long enough, I'd hear the sound of dying. When I walked highways in despair, I heard the leaves applauding where its edges frayed, and my face was undisguised. My children find gauze everywhere they go. One in their games had mica woven in the warp. Its transparent lace can constrain the heart. They say it's just a sparkler they can light and watch be spent. I cannot stop its pattern from traveling up their arms. I tell you, sisters, I'm afraid they will grow used to the same cuts, more fond of their own wounds than lust or love. Father cannot help us now. In our time, we have to struggle from these wrappings, cocoons in need of cracking, tougher on breasts than corsets, hotter at times than a cast, filled with a multitude of insufferable itches. I danced around the dumpster until mine ripped, and the story bloomed above me in the dark. Only then could I recognize the moon. I planned to pry apart the glint inside each wave and ask the sun to melt the remnants of this haze around me. Then I hope the earth will stun me with her power, and I'll gaze at each of you free of its distortions. Remember, my sisters, the sea and the sky, the mountains and hollows, wait for us to break loose and follow that music we hear, music that urges us to move into the mysteries of our America. Come join me. And you have cedar trees here, right? Good. There's a wonderful little cedar tree up in northern Minnesota. And this is the last poem that I'll read. But it's a wonderful little cedar tree. It must be about over 150 years old. And it's out on the middle of a rocky cliff. But the cliff itself is in the water. So it looks as if the tree is out surrounded by the rest of Lake Superior. And it's a very beautiful and strong spirit, and they call it the little spirit cedar tree, you know, because it's been there for so long, and people go and talk to it and find a connection to that area. And so I thought what it would be like, you know, to have been a tree like that. You know, I think that trees try to talk to us, and we need to try to talk to them. And I just felt a connection with it. So I thought I'd like to read this last poem. It's called, You Call Me Less Than All I Am. For ages and ages, under clear summer nights, I bridged wind and stars. See how I live? Every bit of bark, every limb and flat leaf explores a different span. My canopy of edges nourished the origins of your blood, your brooding. Call me a cedar growing from rocks. Call me the record of Earth's blessing. Watch me curve, coil, throw a sinewy hook, then come murmur with me. Let go the rigid patterns of streets and submarines. My resin scents the earth as I grope through the velvet warmth of dirt, just beyond your reach, just in need of your touch. My creators remind me of my girth. My leaves stop stars before your eyes. When the wind fills me, the music I am clings to every branch. Through me, see the processions of stars, the spiral dance of earth. Through me, feel your backbone and your worth. What shelter without my green youth? My spirit always faces south, and yours, when I creak, I offer my home to Katie's that did, to Katie's that didn't. And you?
Okay, thank you.